If he was sitting under the Bodhi tree, 10 o'clock at night, the first watch of the night, really getting into the jhanas, and he thought, now I've got to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to do the morning chanting, he'd have gone to bed and we wouldn't have had a Buddha. You know, he wouldn't have actually developed. So, okay, that's a funny story, but it emphasizes that, you know, meditation is natural. There are times on this retreat, it's absolutely hopeless. You're wasting your time. You better just go in for a walk or have a rest. And there are times on this retreat you'll be really hot. I mean, meditation hot. It's really peaceful. It's going very well. And these damn bells, they go and stop you becoming enlightened. They're terrible. So look, if it's working, carry on. 10 o'clock at night, if you've really got energy, getting very peaceful, things are happening, carry on meditating. You don't have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Carry on. And what that means is sometimes people, they really do get hot. 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, they're still very good. And then they don't have to worry because they know, okay, I don't have to get up till 6 or 7 or something. It doesn't really matter. And that means it becomes natural. Sometimes in the evening, you know, 8, 9 o'clock, you really had it. You're dead. Go and take a rest and get up at 1 o'clock or whatever it is. When you know you can get up any time, you can sleep any time, it means there's no fear. It means you can actually go for it. When the mind gets very hot and you're meditating well, you can go for it. And you don't have to worry about turning up for this schedule and that schedule. And that is incredibly helpful. So you've got a schedule, but those are guidelines. In other words, you don't have to keep them. And usually people who keep those schedules religiously become religious nuts. You know, I've got to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I've got to sort of be here for 6 o'clock every chanting. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. Look, if you want to do that, join the army. You know, this is not army discipline. This is this beautiful meditation discipline. And you know what happens? People get tight inside when they're afraid of, you know, being late. Any time in the middle of my talk, if you come in late, you are totally forgiven. I appreciate you just coming here. Don't feel upset or afraid. You'll find it very hard to offend me. I'm not going to ask you to test me. But, you know, you understand that sometimes that people are just late. They've got to go to the toilet. They've got to finish washing up. And they come in here and they look sort of so guilty as if, you know, that, no, Ajahn Brahm's going to beat them or whatever. No, we don't do that here. So you're perfectly okay. So that means you feel this great sense of freedom and relaxation, which is not just me being a nice guy. This is essential. It's an essential ingredient for you being able to meditate and become peaceful. In other words, it's natural, it's free, no one's going to criticize you, no one's going to blame you. You just be natural, and you'll find with that your meditation gets much better. I noticed a long time ago, when I stopped these schedules, people meditated more. When you had schedules, they kept the schedule, but then after the schedule and the free time, they never meditated at all. 9:30, the last, or 9 o'clock, the last talk, the hall will be empty, and it won't be there until the following morning. But you find when you have no schedule, there's usually people in here 11, 12, 1 o'clock at night. Why are they doing that? Because their meditation is good, they're enjoying it, and they're not afraid of not having enough sleep and having to get up in the morning. So schedules, they're just guidelines. You don't have to keep them at all. You don't have to keep the schedule for lunch. You don't have to have lunch. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Look, you will find, and I guarantee this, 11 o'clock, and some of you will do this, they do it every year, comes 11 o'clock, you're sitting here having such a great time, you don't want lunch. I'll forget about lunch. Because the meditation is just so beautiful and happy. You get lunch tomorrow. Yeah, you're a little bit hungry, but it's not that bad. You can have cheese, chocolate, you can pick out on honey. You know, people actually live on honey. So you've got plenty of stuff there for you in the afternoon. So don't worry about it. The meditation is going good, go for it. If you miss your breakfast, have double lunch. If you miss your lunch, have honey in the evening. If you miss your tea, have double breakfast in the morning. You can eat as much as you like. It's self-service. So don't worry. That's what I mean by having no schedules. Be natural. If you feel tired, ask your body what it needs, ask your mind what it needs, and follow that. Don't ask the schedule what it wants. Ask your body, ask your mind. Is that quite clear? Very good. Because the whole idea of this meditation, I say this is going to be my talk on vanishing. This also emphasizes what happens when you do the walking meditation. I'm going to just emphasize on walking meditation first and then relate it back to what you're doing when you are sitting meditation. When you start walking meditation, now this is another perspective on it. You start there and you're aware of so many things in the world. You're just like a normal person. You're starting walking. All your senses are alert, alive. Okay, maybe not as much as if you're in the city where you've got traffic and shops and people shouting, but you know you're alive, you're here, you're walking. Now the whole purpose is allow as many things as possible to vanish, to disappear. And first of all the perceptions of your home, your work, your life outside this retreat, allow them all to vanish. Husbands, wives, kids, jobs, all that sort of stuff, which is like a big weight which you carry around with you and everywhere else. Just let that go. Now you are like a renunciant for these days. You're like a monk or a nun. You've left your world. Temporarily, yes, it's there for you afterwards. But when you're here, you're someone who's left your world. Getting away from the madding crowd, as Thomas Hardy said. Away from all the rush and bustle. You're living a different lifestyle. You're on retreat from that world, escaping from it for 9 days, being free from it. So you allow it to vanish. And if thoughts of your family, of your work, of all the troubles you left behind before you came here, of all the worries and anxieties which are there for you when you leave, if you keep carrying them on this retreat, you'll have no way of becoming peaceful, no way of getting perspective. There's a simile I gave in opening the door of your heart, which is a very beautiful simile. It's a simile of walking up the mountain or the tower in the middle of the jungle. Life is like a jungle, and sometimes you can't see far enough to get your bearings, and it's very confusing, and sometimes you don't know why things always go wrong, why things are difficult, because in a jungle you can't see far. But you find a tower or little hill, and you climb up that hill, that tower, until you get above the tree line of the jungle. Then you can see vast distances. You can actually see where you are, and where how all the rivers and the villages all relate to one another. You can see the paths. You get the overview. You get to understand the layout of your home, the jungle. When you're above, beyond, outside, only then do you get perspective. And that's actually what happens on a retreat. If you can forget your family, your business, or your past and your future, it's like climbing out of that jungle, going up this tower called Meditation Tower. And when you're at the top there, or even halfway up, when you're out of the jungle, above the tree line, then you get perspective. You can see what the whole problems were, and the way through them. In the jungle, you just can't see. Outside the jungle, you get perspective. So, that's why we have to drop all of those concerns, in order to see them clearly. So, walking meditation. You do have much unfinished business. We all have unfinished business. But, I finish it. I finish it for the retreat. The other great story, Ajahn Buddhadasa's hall story, is a wonderful story, a brilliant monk. He was building his hall and came to the range retreat. He told the builders to go home, and a couple of days later, a visitor came, saw the partially completed hall, and asked the abbot an obvious question: when is your hall going to be finished? To which Ajahn Buddhadasa says, "But sir, it is finished." Which shocked the visitor. "What do you mean it's finished? There's no glass in the windows. There's no roof on it. Now there's cement bags all over the place. When is it going to be finished?" And with great Buddhist wisdom, he said, "Sir, what's done is finished." And then he went off to meditate. That's brilliant. Which means he didn't need to worry about anything. What's done It's finished. So you can be free now. Now, look, you see that, you've seen that teacher's cottage, which is finished up on the hill over there? I'm not worried about it. When it's done, it's finished. So I could care. But I'm not going to worry about it during the retreat. Same as you. All that work and stuff at home, it's all finished. You've tied up all your loose ends. All your responsibilities are finished. Why? Because what's done is finished. If you understand the meaning of that, you understand how to let go. If you want to get things completely just ship-shape before you meditate, you will die before you have any peace at all. What's done is finished. So just, who cares? Just go and meditate. So when you begin your meditation, walking meditation, what's done is finished. I'm free. No past, no future. You're allowing that to vanish and disappear. That's what I mean by vanishing. Vanishings of burdens, obstacles, disappearing, so you can actually go freely. And when that vanishes, again, I've already mentioned, allow time to vanish. So this is why I hate schedules, because they just reinforce time. Sometimes you think, oh, what's the time? 18 minutes past 8, I must finish, you know, by 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock to do this and do that. Which means you're never really in the present moment when you're walking. You're always thinking, how many more minutes to go? How many more minutes I've already got? And that stops you being free. I mean, what is this time anyway? How old are you? How many years have you lived? Does it really feel like 10, 50, 60 years? Time is really weird. And it's also a great prison which we put ourselves in. You don't have to be in that prison. All prisons of the mind, of delusion, always have their cell doors open. It's just we don't want to walk through it. So walk through it and let go of time. You're just walking. Who cares how long? 5 minutes, 10 hours? I don't care. Because I don't watch the watch. I watch the mind. I don't mind the watch. Watch the mind. Don't mind the watch. That's going to appear on a t-shirt one day. And that way, that, you know, you can allow time to vanish. And what a brilliant thing that is. You're just there walking. You haven't got a clue what time of the day it is, what day of the week of the year, what year in the calendar. And this is no exaggeration that that happened to me when I was in Thailand. Not these days, because you've got community meetings, you've got waysacks, rains retreats, all sorts of stuff which I have to deal with. But in the simple life as a monk in Thailand, it did happen to me once. Somebody came into my monastery and I had to sort of write something. And actually, this is absolutely true. I didn't know what year it was. I had to ask them, what year is it now? I'd totally forgotten. And just the idea of time, months and days had totally vanished. When I caught myself, I said, this is amazing. I'm someone who doesn't even know what year it is, let alone what day it is. Although when I came to Australia, one of the reasons I try and remind myself what day and year it is, because the first month or 2 months at the house in North Perth, I still remember this. Lynn may remember this guy, and Don maybe. The guy called Druba, he was from Nepal. He had an epileptic fit, so we had to call the ambulance, and he was helping him into the ambulance. And the first thing the ambulance asked him, he said, what day of the week is it? So why do you ask him that? Oh, if he doesn't know what the day of the week it is, that's a sure sign he's mad, and we take him into the hospital. And I think, please don't ask me that. Because I wouldn't know. So I try to remind myself what the day of the week is in case some ambulance people in white coats ask me. Anyway, so it's great. You let go of time. It vanishes from you. I know what wonderful thing that is. How old you are? I don't know how old I am. I just am. What year is it? I don't know, it's now. What day it is? How many days of the retreat of God? How many days to go? I don't know. Isn't that wonderful? You're just so free. You're just here, you're like a bird, you're like a kid again. You haven't got a clue what time is. Remember kids, like the summer holidays that lasted forever? Because you never counted the days or the hours. I remember some of those summer days in England because the sun came up really early and it went down really late. You're out there playing with your mates and just, it was timeless. Had a great time. One day was just so long and so beautiful. And these days, time is so short. What's the problem? Me. They're worrying about time. That's why it's short. So, allow time to totally vanish and disappear. When you're walking, you're just walking. Don't even look at your clock. Don't worry about how many minutes are there to go. Just be aware of your mind, your body, how you are. If the body's really tired, it'll tell you, enough. Don't matter if that's 5 minutes or 5 hours. If it's enough, it's enough, fine. That way, things start to vanish. You know that one of the hardest things to vanish, one of the biggest obstacles to seeing the truth, is these words in your mind. This inner conversation which can drive you crazy. And for most meditators, that's enemy number one. They just can't stop thinking. And they don't know any peace. They've got this commentary which goes on all the time. Sometimes it's like being in a house and the neighbours are always playing their music. And so it always gets, you know, this incessant, this noise. And that sort of noise from the neighbours is nowhere near as irritating as the noise between your ears. It's like you were born with these two demons inside your brain, and they never stop talking to each other, always arguing. That's that conversation going on inside your head, the two demons who can never shut up. That's called the inner conversation, the chatter. And part of meditation, a huge achievement in meditation, is to see those two demons, the talkative twins, vanish and shut up. Peace at last. I can just be without these voices inside me saying, meditate harder. You're not trying hard enough. Get up. Yeah, I know Ajahn Brahm said you don't have to get up, but I do have to get up. I came on this retreat. I want to get enlightened. What am I going to say to my friends afterwards if they say I spent 9 days sleeping, I never got anywhere? How stupid I would feel. I don't know if that's your conversation, but people have these conversations inside of them which go on and on and on. If it's not talking about the meditation, it's going on some fantasy realm about, I don't know what your fantasies are. Maybe you can write them down and tell me. But they have these fantasies of being like Harry Potter or being a wizard or being sort of a football player or whatever your fantasy is. And you go dreaming about it, thinking about it over and over and over and over again. Wasting so much time. You're not here. So, how is that overcome? Straight away by overcoming time, being free of time. A lot of that inner conversation settles down. And just being in this moment, aware, and realizing you don't have to give things a name. Who is this funny person in a brown robe sitting in front of you? What's his name? Sometimes you say, Ajahn Brahm. In Thailand, I'm Prat Wisuddhi Sangwarathera. Sometimes they say, do you know Prat Wisuddhi Sangwarathera? He lives in Perth. Never heard of him. You go and see my friends in England, the ones I grew up with, Peter Betts. Oh yeah, Peter Betts, he lives in England. And he lives in Perth. He's got a monastery down there. Peter Betts, never heard of him. That monastery is owned by or run by Ajahn Brahm. Who am I? So a lot of these things, you give it a name, and it's not accurate. Who are you anyway? So stop giving things names. This is an old, another water bottle experiment. You have to participate in this. Audience participation keeps people awake. What is this I'm holding up? Who knows what it is? Water bottle, yeah. What else? What else? What can you see? Water bottle, yeah, we've had that. Plastic, yeah, keep on going. What else can you see? Colour, blue colour, anything else? Yeah, what else can you see? Describe it to me. Cap, yeah, anything else? Keep going. Is that what it is? Cylinder shape, yeah, keep on going. You notice that's all words. That's what you've been taught in school, you know, to give things names. But is that what this really is? The nice thing is when you look at something, or when you run out of names, then you can see things. It's not a water bottle. It's not a cylinder. It's not blue. It's not just a cap. It's much, much more than that. The names stop you seeing the truth. They see just a small part, and you think that's what it is. Monk. There's much more to me than just being monk. I'm also comedian. Builder. I don't know what else it is. But you see, it's much more than that. You say girl. You're not much more than a girl. All you know, if people just look at you as girls, it's terrible. It's just gender specific. You're a being. You're a person. So when they give you a name, they limit you. You're only seeing a tiny fraction of who that one is. When you run out of all the names, then you can actually start to see things. Now you understand why all those names actually stop you seeing the truth. That's a problem. So, in order to allow speech to vanish, we take away its value. We realize it's not going to lead you to truth and to insight. It's just going to stop you seeing things. When we put the value in silence, then silence grows. When we value thinking, thinking grows. And the only reason why the inner speech continues inside of you is because you've been brainwashed since you were kids into valuing it, thinking it's important, assuming it's going to lead you to solutions and truth. And you should know by now, how many years have you been thinking and you're still so damn stupid? It hasn't led you anywhere, has it? Into arguments, yes. Solves a few worldly problems, but ever actually shown you the truth and deep meaning? Never does. It actually stops that. The Buddha in the suttas, he didn't pull his punches. He described thinking like this. A young boy, a young girl, dressed up to the nines, makeup, washed, groomed, were going out at night. And the boy or the girl discovered that, without them knowing, someone had slipped a necklace of dead dog rotting carcasses around their neck. And they'd just washed, makeup, scent, groomed, everything. And someone, this dirty, stinky dog carcasses. Well, forget about dog carcasses, you don't see those. But if you just walk up the road, there's quite a couple of kangaroo carcasses out there, rotting away. Just if you go out the gate and turn right, maybe what's it, 100 meters, there's one down there, stinky. Imagine putting that around your neck and coming into this meditation hall. Please don't do that. It's not a chance. You know, be really careful these days, because I suggest these things. Like, some weird people think, yeah, I'm going to do that. But imagine you did that. That's stinky. That's awful. Now, that is what the Buddha described thoughts as. He said it's like a necklace of rotting dog carcasses strung around your beautiful mind. He said, why do people do that? So that's how the Buddha, thoughts and the mind, dead dog carcasses, to do something of beauty. But we value those thoughts, don't we? That's why we keep thinking and thinking and thinking. We assume we're going to understand something and get somewhere. Even the talk which I've given now, many of you will start thinking about it afterwards. Fools, idiots, stop thinking about it. You don't get anywhere that way. So, by not valuing the thoughts, instead we value the silence. One of the reasons we're here in this place is a very silent place. Isn't that one of the great benefits of coming to Jhana Grove? So quiet. Can't you appreciate that silence and value it? So why do you disturb the silence with your thoughts? If you're thinking inside about this talk, about your family, about your business, about your organization, if you're thinking about anything, you can't hear the silence. You're not enjoying Jhana Grove. You might as well be in some busy shopping mall in the big middle of the city. You're not benefiting from the quietness of this wonderful environment. So, in order to stop that inner conversation, we value the silence. When you go outside, listen to the silence. Listen to the sound of the leaves rustling in the wind, the birds. The only way you can listen to that is if inside you're quiet. That's the silence. If you value that, after a while it just grows on you. You don't let it go. You don't sort of abandon it because it's valuable. You let go of the thoughts instead. Things of very little value. So you're walking backwards and forwards, just valuing the precious silence, until all the conversations vanish. The noise between your ears disappears. Oh, what bliss! Free at last! Aho sukhang! Aho sukhang! It's wonderful being silent. Then you find out that much of those thoughts, they're the ones which send you depressed. I'm not good enough, life's terrible, rah rah rah. That goes on in your head for long enough and make anyone depressed. Guilt, what they did to me, they shouldn't have done that to me. They're wrong, they mustn't have done that to me. That's really terrible. That makes you angry. You build it up with your terrible thoughts. I'm sick, I'm ill, it's unfair. You make yourself sick with those thoughts. Be silent. And you're free. Something amazing has vanished. There's more to vanish yet. Once you get into vanishing, it means renouncing, letting things go. If you let things go, they disappear. That's what letting go means. They vanish. They disappear. So the next thing we let go of. What we let go of so far? All our worldly things, business and stuff, time, inner conversation. Then, our body. I mentioned that last night. My body sucks. Your body does the same. Especially some of you, I've known you for a long time. You have terrible gut aches, old age, ear aches, headaches, tummy aches, leg aches, ear aches. There's no end to the aches. Any part of your body can ache at any time, and often many do it all together in unison. There's always something aching. Oh, my nose is itchy again. Such a burden, having this body. I remember when I was the monk in Thailand, we had to meditate. I was actually quite fit and healthy in those days. And had to meditate out under the trees in the evening, being close to nature. Do you like being close to nature? Only people in the city have this myth about going natural is happy. Nature wants to eat you. That's why we have cities, actually, to get away from the inconvenience of nature. So people say, oh, it's wonderful, you monks, living close to nature, close to the trees, close to the greenery. No, what it really is close to the ticks, close to the flies, close to the mosquitoes, close to all these things which are trying to eat me. I really, when people say, oh, it must be wonderful living in nature, so you don't know what nature is. Even in Thailand, some of our monks, and I say this, they have these great myths of going to these forest monasteries with these enlightened monks and living in these kutis in the forest. They don't know about the snakes, the centipedes, the scorpions, the mosquitoes, because no one ever says anything about them when they describe their wonderful days in Thailand, living in the mountains, just next to the water, next to the waterfalls. They never mention the leeches and all the other, yucky stuff which gets on you. But the worst thing in Thailand at that time was the mosquitoes. And you don't know mosquitoes over here. You get maybe one over here. That's just maybe one a day. There's nothing. These were hundreds of them swarming. This was a jungle. And just for some reason, Ajahn Chah said, right, in the evening, the first years of Wat Danachat, we're going to meditate 6 o'clock in the evening. meditate for an hour or two, and then you'll give a talk, do some chanting, then give a talk. That was the time the mosquitoes came out, you know, just before dusk. And so we had to meditate there with all these mosquitoes. It was only afterwards I thought, you know, this guy was some masochist or something, but it's only afterwards I realized that for the Thai people, your blood vessels are a little bit deeper under the skin because, you know, you've grown up, you've been genetically modified, you know, to deal with mosquitoes. You know, there's no mosquitoes in London. It's too cold there. So I was not prepared for this. So this, all the mosquitoes, this is no joke, no exaggeration, they would all land on the Western monks, maybe 100 to 1 at least. So we get them all. So that, it was all right for Ajahn Chah. He was having a nice time, his meditation, but we were getting eaten bits. And now that was incredibly irritating. It was torture, basically. Now, 60 or 70 mosquitoes on you at one go. How did you handle that? The only way I handled it, because fortunately I had learned some decent meditation before I became a monk. I had a good teacher. I could let go of my body and let it vanish. Just what a great relief that was. You'd be meditating there, these terrible mosquitoes, you just let the body go until you couldn't feel your body anymore. Someone could have touched you, they could have hit you, wouldn't have felt it at all. You're totally deep inside. And that's the way I managed with those mosquitoes. After 5 or 10 minutes, I couldn't feel anything. Because you let go of your body. Oh, what a great relief that was. I remember doing that when I had typhus fever. This terrible ache, fever and stuff in your body, and just let the body go and go deep inside and have just a wonderful time. So, that was actually extremes which taught me how to do that. But now you can do that whenever you like. You're walking meditation. Yeah, you may have a tummy ache. Just watch your feet. Just watch the feelings in the feet and just you focus on that until you can't feel anything else in your whole body. Just the movement of the feet. You can't feel the head. You can't feel the arms, you're just the feet, that's all. They totally take up every bit of space in your mind. And don't think that that's an amazing superpower thing to do. People in the world do that every time. They're watching a movie. I just mentioned Harry Potter, watching Harry Potter movie there. And your legs can ache, you can have a stomach ache and gut ache. You don't feel the gut ache when you're watching Harry Potter, especially when it's coming to the climax. Is he going to win? Is he going to lose? Is he going to get killed? Whatever's going to happen. Or when it's a rom-com, they call. Oh, they're going to meet together. They're going to fall in love. They're going to meet. Oh, it's so nice. You don't realize you're really busting to go to the toilet. Why is that? Because something else of importance and joy is taking up all the space in the mind. You can't feel the pain in your bladder. You do that often. And it's that same thing we use in meditation. So if you really focus on the feelings in your feet, and actually they do become quite pleasant after a while, it becomes really interesting. You can't feel anything else. You can't hear. That story which I often tell, meditating, walking meditation in Bangkok of all places. I found a nice place outside the temple to meditate for an hour walking meditation. And it's natural. If you can do a natural pace, you don't have to walk fast or slow, but as you really get into it, you tend to slow down. The reason is there's too many things happening. You really, the amount of feelings going on when you just lift your foot is amazing. And I was getting really into it, just lifting a foot. And just you do it so slowly because you can't rush it. There's too many things happening, too many things to watch. And it was fascinating and really joyful. And I was just totally immersed in my own little world of just watching the movement of my feet. I didn't force this. I didn't make it happen. Just natural. This is just what happens. And that's when, just a million miles away, I heard this sound. Brahma Wangs Ho, Brahma Wangs Ho. And I thought, what is that? And I realized there was a monk shouting in my ear. I was late for an appointment. But you were so involved in your own little world there. It was like it was thousands of miles. You could hardly hear it. And he was trying desperately to get my attention. And so I had to turn around. It took me three or four minutes to turn my head around and answer him. Because you were just so peaceful and still in your own little world. Even sound, you just couldn't hear. You know, so eventually I came out of my lovely vanishing walking meditation to attend to him and to go off to the Dharana. But I remember that experience. It was a wonderful. It was obviously it was very good that he was a monk and he knew that I'd been meditating. So he understood I hadn't gone crazy. I wasn't psychotic. It was just what happens when you get into peaceful meditation. The whole world outside vanished. Couldn't hear sounds. Couldn't feel my body. Just feeling the movement in my feet. That is vanishing. That is samadhi. That is stillness. That is beautiful. Happy. You have a wonderful time. And hopefully that happens to you. That's as far as you can take walking meditation. If the rest of your body vanishes, I never thought this could be done. I always thought you can't get into jhana during walking meditation. One of the monks in Thailand said, yes, you can. He had the proof because he saw this monk who could get into jhana while he was doing walking meditation. And the proof was all the cuts and bruises on his head. Otherwise your body disappears. Yeah, you just carry on walking until you hit a wall or a bush or something. So this poor old monk was all cut and bruised because his body totally disappeared and he was carried on walking. Not to be recommended. But if that does happen to you, we can actually go and borrow a crash helmet and a protective suit for you. But that certainly does happen when you're sitting meditation. You sit meditation here, allow things to vanish. That's called letting go. When things disappear, you have let go. It's a sign that letting go has been fulfilled. So you're sitting here, and you're not thinking at all about all the problems in your life, all the things you have to deal with. That's all vanished. Well done. You've let go of your world. And appreciate that. And appreciate how free you feel. You really are on holiday. You're vacation. That's what vacation means. Your mind has been vacated from all this stuff which oppresses you from day to day. No family, no husband, no kids, no wife, no job, no money, nothing at all. I don't have to worry about anything. Oh, you deserve that. You deserve that break from your world. Well done. You've let that go. And then you're meditating here, and you realize you don't know what time it is. How many minutes you've meditated, how many minutes left? Haven't got a clue. Well done, you've let go of time. No memories of the past, no expectations or plans for the future. You're not trying to get anywhere, you're not worried about where you've been. You're just right here, enjoying this moment. Free. Well done. Time has vanished. Oh, what bliss. You do actually feel that. You feel these great weights and burdens that just disappear. You do feel like a bird, free, being able to fly wherever you want. Like a person being released from a prison. Oh, I'm out. I can go wherever I want. Nothing is holding me back. And all your thoughts and thinking. I'll just stop my thoughts for a minute. That's what it's like. It's beautiful. You don't have to do anything. Totally still. So you can be in life rather than be in the commentary to life. You're right here where the action is. That's brilliant. That's beautiful. So please, at the very least, develop as much inner silence. That is the real noble silence. That's actually what it said in the suttas. Noble silence was the silence of second jhana. You know, but meditators have used that for keeping people quiet. That's like school noble silence when no one's allowed to speak. Forget about that one. Keep the real noble silence. The noble silence between your ears. Free of that inner commentary. When it does vanish, brilliant, well done. And you know it's nice, you know it's free, you know this is meditation, because it feels incredibly spiritual, holy, relief. You're getting somewhere. This is what meditation is all about. I haven't mentioned about watching the breath or getting limiters. This is the real stuff, okay? Not attaining things, but feeling things. Peaceful, still. You stay in that for a long time, you have just a blissful time. You're really flying. You're having a wonderful day. With all these thoughts just gone, and just be free at last. And then, but you've got your body, my itchy nose. And, you know, want to go to the toilet, want to do this. So you sit down there. And this is actually where, when you let go of the past, and when you let go of the future, you let go of all the thinking. It's the nature of the mind, it's just what's left to watch. And if you've got your eyes closed, the thing which is still moving, when you've let go of the past and all your thinking, the one part of your body which is still moving is your breath. Yeah, the heart is still moving, but the breath is much more loud, as it were. Which is why that when you sit down and your body starts to disappear, that's why that the breath is the natural object which comes up whether you choose to do it or you don't choose to do it. Which is why the Buddha taught breath meditation, because it happens. It's natural. You don't choose it. That's what I don't think I ever choose to watch the breath these days. I just sit there and start letting go. Being in the moment. Just being here. And my mind gets very still, no thoughts. And I notice my mind's just watching the breath, because that's the only thing moving left to watch. Everything else has vanished. So just, you're watching the breath. And the thing with the breath is, you're watching the breath, and no other part of your body. So after a while, the other parts of the body will vanish. When I'm watching the breath, I can't feel my nose anymore. And please don't watch the breath at the tip of your nose. Don't watch the breath at your tummy. Don't watch the breath anywhere. Just watch the breath. You're not watching the body, you're watching the breath. Right now, those of you looking at me, are you watching me or are you watching my seat? You're watching me, not where I'm sitting. So the same with the breath. You watch the breath, not where the breath is manifesting. You're not watching the breath seat, you're watching the breath. You're not watching the nose, you're not watching the belly, you're watching the breath. It's a very important point there if you're doing breath meditation. I learned that very early on, thank goodness for that. I can know the breath is going in, I can know the breath is going out, but I don't care at all where the breath is going in. It could be going in through my ear hole, if I don't care. I just watch the breath, without focusing on any part of the body, because I want my body to disappear. And the sooner you let go of the body and allow it to vanish, the better. I think I mentioned there, if you don't let go of the body early, when the mind starts to get some energy, that energy flows into that body and just messes things up. Gives, you know, high energy states, but it's very disturbing after a while. The energy going up and down your spine, through your head, making you shake and all sorts of other stuff. Yeah, it's interesting stuff, it's weird, but it's not helpful because your energy is going into the body, it should be going into the mind. If you haven't let go of the body yet. So you're just watching the breath and all the rest of the body disappears. That much, you're free. You can't feel the mosquitoes. You can't feel your irritable bowel syndrome. You can't feel your headache. You can't feel anything else. All you've got left is the breath and the rest of your body is totally vanished. Oh, Aho Sukhang. All of you are sick, and that means everyone in this room. Aho Sukhang, all this irritation is gone. And then, of course, the next thing is when your breath disappears. The breath is like a stepping stone from body awareness to mind awareness. You've let go of most of your body, you've almost crossed the stream, but you've still got the breath awareness. But just because you're watching the breath and just leaving it alone, it calms and calms. And calms until it disappears. It's gone. You can't even feel your breath. And what's left is the mind. The breath has vanished. Well done. That's a really big state. The breath has vanished, the body has vanished, time has vanished, the speech has vanished. Now you're getting into the deep meditations. That's usually where these nimittas arise. They arise not because you're looking for them. It's just what's left, that's all. Your mind is what's left. And that usually appears as this beautiful bright light. Well done. But if that light appears and your body hasn't totally vanished yet, it's not going to last very long. Make sure the whole body has vanished, and so you just got the mind left. The whole five senses have gone. The body is gone. Time is gone. Thinking is gone. Whee! Now you're just like a balloon, just floating up in the sky with nothing in it. Not tied down to anything. Oh, Aho Sukhang. It's vanishing. And now, something else has to vanish. And that is your mind. That's what the jhanas are all about. The mind disappearing. The greatest vanishing act of all. The first jhana to the second jhana. Something vanished. The second to the third. More of your mind has vanished. Knowing, consciousness is vanishing and disappearing. And you know, the more it disappears, the happier you are, the more free. And just like you realize this body sucks, now you realize this mind sucks as well. Consciousness sucks. Consciousness is suffering. To know is to suffer. Even knowing the most blissful things, like the bliss of jhanas, is suffering. Your whole mind vanishes. The last of your five khandhas disappears. Now you're free. That's called nibbana. The end of the khandhas. The greatest vanishing act in samsara. And you're part of that. Well done. That's the art of vanishing, which is the title of my new book, coming out soon, available from Wisdom. I don't know when, but coming out soon. The last edit has been done and sent off to them. So I think it's actually next autumn. So you have got the preview, the art of vanishing. So get out of here, all of you. Vanish, poof. Disappear. Okay? So that's the talk on vanishing. And it gives you another perspective of what this meditation is. See how much can disappear. The more it disappears, the more happy, blissful and free you feel. I just told you how to do it. Easy. Any questions? No? Good. Okay, John has got one. Go on. Okay, I'm glad you mentioned the word emptiness, because I'll repeat your question in a moment, because what I've just described is just the essence of the Sunyata Suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is not what I invent up myself. This was Buddha knew all of this, and so this is the essence of the Sunyata Sutta. Forget it's a Chula Maha Sunyata Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. Read that and you find out what I've just said is just about what the Buddha said today. So this is like a Buddha Sutta you heard today. And you're saying, can you please go over again how you move from the thinking mind into like the emptiness, the still mind. And the main piece of encouragement, advice I gave you today, taking away the value from thinking and giving more value to silence. Even brainwashing yourself, convincing yourself that thinking doesn't get you anywhere. It's a carcass of a dead dog around your beautiful mind. It never shows you the truth. It only shows you a tiny part of what's out there, to the exclusion of everything else. So you don't get the full picture when you're thinking. So it's a partial picture. Not even 50%, maybe 5% or 1% at most. So you take away the value from thinking. It's not truthful. It's deceptive. It doesn't lead you to anywhere. It's not beautiful. It's not advisable. So look upon your thinking as an affliction. That takes a lot, because in our society that we praise thinkers. We put busts of great thinkers on our desks. We have statues of the great thinkers of the world. But I like statues of the great non-thinkers, the ones who can stop the mind, who value silence rather than thought. So put the value into silence. Take it away from thinking. Don't think about that. That's much better, John. Be silent and value that. Because whatever you value, you encourage. If you value the thoughts, you're encouraging them. You get into some philosophical debate with yourself. Wow, this is really getting somewhere. Yeah, I'm understanding some Dhamma. No, you're not. Shut up. And then you understand Dhamma. Take away the value. Whatever you value, that's what you spend time on. Yes, Nora. Okay. Are you asking a question of an experience of disassociation, shock or trauma, where especially with a kid just having a perception of being apart from their body, looking at their body, and being told afterwards, you must come back, you must come back. Again, this is not being aware of your body at all, but just all awareness of the body totally vanishing. You're not sort of outside your body looking in. You know, in the body looking out, the whole body perception has totally vanished and disappeared. Totally different experience. And of course, the experience of being outside your body looking at it is usually quite shocking, disturbing. It doesn't have the energy, the peace and the beauty and incredible happiness of the one where your body totally disappears. And you're totally free of this body. So it's a different experience, a different causes, and it feels just much, 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 much different. So is this not a disassociation, it's a disappearance. So it's just gone. And it's, again, I've given some indications which just about everybody would have experienced from time to time. When you're so focused on one thing, just like if it's a movie, or like I've heard that people say playing sports, and maybe playing soccer or rugby, and they break their leg. If I broke their leg, it will hurt a lot. But sometimes they break their leg and they carry on playing the game because they're so focused on the game they don't actually feel any pain. It's amazing. Or you've had these stories of people in these car accidents and they've taken their partner or someone, carried them, and they've got broken bones and goodness knows what else is happening to them. It's actually impossible they could actually done that without feeling any pain. They'd be focused on saving someone else. They just literally don't feel their own body. And many times that has happened. I remember that what comes to mind. There was a big fire on a Navy ship just off West Australia. And one of the heroes, it was fully smoke. I think it was carrying someone else out. The only way he could feel his way out, he had to feel his way out, was by touching the pipes, which were white hot. He burnt his hand off. But he could actually do that, and he could endure intolerable pain. He wasn't thinking about his pain. He was thinking about the person he was saving. So we do let go of our body from time to time. And it's that sort of, not the disassociation for some sort of trauma, but more like a very positive focusing on something else. So the whole body just vanishes. And it's the irritation of the body. The one which is there all the time. You're getting on now, Noel, and so am I. And just things are falling apart. You don't have the sort of the energy and the freedom from aches and irritations we used to have when we were kids. So, sometimes they have in times, a couple of Thai people here. Old people. Now the word for Mr. is poor, and Mrs. is mayor. So they used to call old people poor oi and mayor oi. That's like a grandfather and grandmother. And the reason they call them poor oi, and they're oi, because whenever they get up, they say oi, 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 oi. That's true. They're oi and poor oi, because they're always going oi, 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 oi. So that's, you know, the English way would be like grandmother moan, grandfather moan. That's actually in the language, because that's what it's like when you get old. So it's great to be free of the body. Okay, so now you're going to be free of me, because there are interviews now. So those on interviews, strictly 10 minutes. I'm not letting go of time during the interviews. So otherwise I'll miss my sort of lunch. So interview.